a good question.
Thank
so,
you.
I was trying to reflect the upbeat attitude that the team, the president, that his course of illness has had. Didn't want to give any information that might steer the course of illness in another direction. And in doing so, you know, it came off that we were trying to hide something, which wasn't necessarily true. Here I have it. The fact of the matter is that he's doing really well. That he is responding, and as the team said, if everything continues to go well, we're going to start discharge planning back to the White House.
That was Dr. Sean Conley on Sunday attempting to explain to reporters why the day before he had given them misleading information about the health and treatment of his coronavirus patient, President Donald Trump. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. I'm Matt Welch, joined by my Reason colleagues, Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Good Monday, people.
Howdy.
Matt,
oh my God, it is Monday.
Matt, it's very disrespectful of you not to use the president's middle initial.
Yes.
I think you want to retape that.
Yes. J.
You would never say that about Lyndon Baines Johnson.
Barack H. Obama.
Yes, exactly. Thank you.
So let's see. Has anything happened since the last time we talked? Peter, who's losing his mind, and I'm sure we'll hear that soon enough, was commenting earlier that Elizabeth Nolan Brown's Monday Roundup is just basically a list of who in the White House has contracted or tested positive for coronavirus, and in Congress too. So let's actually read a little bit of a list here. So the September 26th, there was a ceremony in the White House Rose Garden to welcome Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett. People who were at that, who have since tested positive for COVID-19, include President Trump, First Lady Melania Trump, White House Advisor Kellyanne Conway, and also her daughter, former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, Notre Dame President John Jenkins, Republican National Committee Chair Rona McDaniel Romney, Senators Mike Lee and Tom Tillis, among others. And then there's other White House people who have been tested positive recently, including Trump campaign manager Bill Stepien. I'm sure that's not how you pronounce his name. Senator Ron Johnson and presidential advisor Hope Hicks, who the reporting of whose positive test kind of was the beginning of the cascade of information here. And information is a very strongly termed word, considering the absolute mess of communications that have come out from the White House over the past few days, which we may or may not get into in greater detail. But Peter Suderman, if you can snap out of it, I wanted you to talk a little bit about the kind of toughly worded op-ed in the Wall Street Journal from today or yesterday by Trump's own former FDA chief, Scott Gottlieb, who we've mentioned here a time or two before, and also conservative policy dude Yuval Levin, who write, quote, "It didn't have to happen. Mr. Trump and his team aren't passive victims of bad luck and an aggressive virus. Their bad attitude," bad is a inserted bracket for me, "was reflected in policy choices that put the president and nation at risk." So, Peter, they are spinning. They're not spinning, but they're portraying this in a broader context of policy response. What are they going on about, and how can we think about the sort of White House and federal coronavirus policy in light of the president's own case?
So that op-ed is interesting because it comes from two people on the right, one of whom was a top official in the Trump administration, not just a top official in the Trump administration, a top healthcare official, ran the FDA for a while, and then through earlier in this year, served as a kind of informal advisor. I was participating in, you know, in White House calls, that sort of thing, and in some ways was one of the sort of informal spokespeople for the White House's coronavirus response team. So not someone who is knee-jerk hostile to the president at all. And what they do is they make a case that what has happened in the White House was not just a sort of random act that nobody could have done anything about. And also they connect it, and I think this is important, they connect it to the policy failures of this White House and of this president, in particular to the failures of the CDC early on and the FDA after Scott Gottlieb left to get testing rolled out, but also the failure of the president to model for the nation and to depoliticize the mask issue. They make, you know, they have a very striking comparison in that piece that if you look at Australia, Hong Kong, Japan, Malaysia, New Zealand, Singapore, South Korea, Taiwan, Thailand, and Vietnam combined, all of those countries combined are seeing an average of fewer than 1,000 new coronavirus cases a day at this point. That's fewer cases in all of those countries than just in the city of Los Angeles. On October 2nd, there were 44,985 confirmed cases of coronavirus in the United States as a whole. That is very common. We are regularly in the well into the 40,000 new cases each day. And I think the thing that they're getting at is that this is an example of an ongoing example of presidential irresponsibility. And think about the debate that was last week. I mean, which is crazy that that happened also last week. At the debate on Tuesday, President Trump mocked Biden extensively, as he has in the past, for mask wearing and for holding socially distanced events. Trump has done this before. And inside the White House, we know for certain they didn't take basic steps to prevent the spread. Just basic common sense steps. They looked on people who did take those steps with disdain. This was incredibly reckless of the Trump White House. This was stupid and reckless, and it was unnecessary with even an ounce of forethought or coordination or competence. And it's because Trump is a stupid and incompetent person, reckless person who runs a stupid, incompetent, reckless White House. He puts lives at risk, including his own. And we are all living under that and because of that. Trump is not just some schmo. He's the president of the United States. He is the commander in chief of the largest military history has ever known. He is the person who gets to make the call on nuclear weapons decisions. And while he's been up and tweeting today, it is not at all clear, not in any way, that he has been fully in control of himself or his faculties for the last several days. According to his own doctors, his blood oxygen dropped substantially twice to worrying levels. He's on experimental treatments, which, great, we should all have that kind of access, but suggest that his case is quite serious. His doctor admitted to misrepresenting information about the president's health in order to make it seem better than it actually was. If there was a crisis right now, I mean, another one. If there is a crisis, then the buck stops with Trump. He's the one who has to act if North Korea fires a nuclear missile. He is the one whose job is to act swiftly and decisively if something unexpected or out of the ordinary happens. But the thing that is unexpected and out of the ordinary that keeps happening is Donald Trump himself every single day for 4 years.
So
Trump has been the crisis.
Peter, I mean, like, to step down a little bit, okay? First off, and like, you know, Los Angeles, is Los Angeles controlled by Donald Trump? If Los Angeles has a bunch of cases and a failed coronavirus response, it's not all because of Donald Trump or anything like that. And this is, you know, I don't know. I do not
Does the president have any responsibility for anything, Nick?
Sure, yeah. Sure, he does. Okay. But maybe, you know, did the people at the White House set their own risk level? Because isn't that the way that we've been talking about the proper response to coronavirus?
And yes, if we want to talk, if we want to talk about model good policy, yeah, to set good policy, and then for people to take individual responsibility for themselves
policy?
And Trump and the White House, no one in the White House did that. And they did it in large part because Trump mocked it and disdained taking personal responsibility here.
So they are not adults, et cetera. Trump, I'm curious.
They're like, certainly not people, acting
wait,
like it.
Wait, may I? Trump is a buffoon and an idiot. We know that. But I refuse to allow my entire world to be drawn down to, I have to pay attention to Donald Trump every minute of every day. And everything that is good or bad or indifferent that happens is somehow directly linked to Donald Trump. That is the definition of Trump derangement syndrome.
If the
okay, I do. You have said
checked into Walter Reed, we wouldn't have to be paying attention to it.
Because we wouldn't be talking about Trump 24/7. you know, be otherwise. This is a massive embarrassment for the president, and I suspect it will be the final nail in the coffin of his reelection campaign. And then we can get on talking about what life is going to be like under a Joe Biden administration, probably with a Democratic Senate, which is going to be god awful. And that doesn't mean that we don't fixate on Trump and what's bad about him, but the national response to coronavirus has been a failure, not simply, and I would argue in many ways, not even mostly because of Donald Trump. I mean, the CDC and the FDA, which screwed all of this stuff up, are filled with lifers. And they are like the vector point for everything going haywire immediately. Matt and I live in a state and a city that has been run incompetently since the lockdown. I do not think the United States has responded well to the lock or to coronavirus, but that it is like to go off on an idea that everything bad is because of Donald Trump and that we are now, you know, one nuke strike away from war with North Korea. That is alarmist, and I think it's misinformed.
Let's split the baby, Catherine, by which I mean taking out a saw and sawing a baby in half for fun. One of the many ironies here, Catherine, is it not that at the debate last decade, the presidential debate between Donald Trump and Joe Biden, just about the only kind of good sustained point that the president made, at least according to me, maybe you disagree, is that was over coronavirus shutdowns, in which he pointed out, and I think he's right, that it's destroying people. Maybe that's a bit too strong, sending them to alcoholism, drugs, and divorce. And he wasn't just talking about me. Biden kind of wants to do them open-ended forever from the federal point of view, and then that's bad. And Biden had a pretty weak response about, like, wow, we just need a plan. So Trump scores one good point there, and now that there's no way for that point to land in the ensuing conversation that we're having in America.
Yeah, I don't know that there was ever a way for that point to land, really. That is to say, almost everyone has already made up their minds, not only about Donald Trump and Joe Biden, but also about the country's coronavirus response. And I think it's interesting, actually, that like everyone thinks we did a bad job. Even if you are a real hardcore extremist on the everything should be open and it should be down to the individual only about what precautions are taken or not taken, or if you are all the way to a there should have been a full, you know, house arrest lockdown with the death penalty for people who violate it, it's still everyone thinks that that this is a story of government failure, and everyone is right. The muddle through, schizophrenia, back and forth, worst case scenario that we managed to execute here is, in fact, a tremendous government failure. And it is a product of underlying problems with our system that are not specific only to Donald Trump or wouldn't be necessarily obviated by Joe Biden. I do think, though, that for those of us who have asked for a significant element of local decision making and personal responsibility in lockdowns, in the decision about protective measures like mask wearing, like distancing, like changing the way that you conduct your daily business, that the White House story is relevant, and that a lot of people were looking at those photos of the Rose Garden ceremony and saying, if all of these powerful people think it's okay to sit this close together, they might know things that I don't know. They might have a better understanding of the world that I don't have. And I'm maybe going to follow their model. To me, the biggest question, though, is I have long, of course, as listeners of this podcast know, been a non-voter and in general, like a muddle thrower. Like, I just think like we're generally okay. We generally do okay. Even when things are very bad seeming, we generally do okay. But one thing that I've always come back to is like, you know what America is great at? Peaceful transfer of power. Like, we do that stuff better than anybody else in the world. Boy, are we good at peaceful transfer of power. And the president getting coronavirus right freaking now is not gonna smooth the way for a clear, unambiguous, election result and peaceful transfer of power. Now, I'm not saying it's actually going to make it impossible. I still think we're probably going to have a nice, smooth, peaceful transfer of power in the end. I do. Maybe it'll look more like 2000 than I would like, but still, I think we're going to do it. I believe that. But like this didn't help. This isn't great. And
just a week or two after Trump himself repeatedly declined to say that he would go along the peaceful transfer of power if he lost the election. And again, this is not everything is about Trump, but national politics is heavily, substantially.
Like the question of whether the sitting president will peacefully leave the White House is about the sitting president.
Yes.
That is a thing that is about the sitting president.
Go ahead, Nick.
Matt, are you worried about the peaceful transfer of power?
Do you
seriously entertain deep thoughts that Trump is going to hide in the attic of the White House or in the walls?
Oh my God, Donald Trump, but Jane Eyre. Like, can we do it? Jane Eyre, but make it the White House?
All over the place. No, but I mean, seriously, Matt, I'm curious because this is part of the rhetoric around all of this stuff. And Trump totally abets this. He swims in this and lives in it. But it's like, I mean, who do you guys seriously think that Trump will refuse to leave the White House if he loses the election?
I don't think,
as opposed to, oh, my God, like,
I don't think that's the most likely scenario isn't a very, very clear and unambiguous loss. I think the election results are going to be messy for lots of reasons that are outside of the president's control.
Absolutely.
And that a president with a different temperament who is not also potentially mortally ill.
So then lay out the scenario in which he's like, you know what? It's 8 weeks later. The results have been certified. But it's within a couple of points or something, and I still have brain fog from COVID, so I'm not leaving. I mean, seriously, do you really entertain the idea that Donald Trump and that, you know, who is back down to every legal challenge and most even rhetorical challenges when faced, is really going to barricade himself in the White House?
I do not think there will be a physical barricading in. I do think the scenario.
All right. So there is no refusal to leave power.
Those are two different things. He could use legal and formal channels to sue, to demand recounts, to delay the results of the election.
Right. I mean, that's what Al Gore did. Al Gore did for a long time until he lost.
If that is not in the country's best interest.
I mean, that's a peaceful transfer of power. It was under Al Gore, it was in the country's best interest to litigate that to the high court. I actually think the Supreme Court got it wrong.
Right.
But I mean,
do you remember two minutes ago, Nick?
Why are we alarmist and talking about, you know, oh, my God, Trump is ill. We have the specter of North Korea. He's not going to leave office. It just strikes me as a bizarre phantasm that we're kind
of. It strikes me as bizarre that you are acting like all of your colleagues on this podcast and much of the country's concerns are unfounded. Like, unless you genuinely think that having heightened concern about a smooth transition after this election is completely unfounded, and I don't think you think that, then it is a reasonable topic to discuss.
I think it is virtually completely unfounded. And the only reason we are talking about it is because a Playboy correspondent asked Donald Trump a question, which as a troll, and again, I hope Trump loses. You know, I hope Joe Biden loses because we have all already lost. But it's like this is all like kabuki theater that is just, it's not going to
happen.
First
of all, no kink shaming on Playboy, Nick. I want you to retract. Second of all,
If Playboy, by the way, Matt, if you've checked it in the past 30 years,
not a lot of kink in there.
You know, they've kind of gone their separate ways.
Second of all, I think this is the part where I'm contractually obliged to introduce the phrase tail risk. It's about the tail risk, Nick. And thirdly, it's worth pointing out that, yes, the press is ridiculous in always asking Trump this question, which they did in 2016. This was like 7,000 news cycles at this time in 2016.
And by the way, who is the one who hasn't accepted the 2016 election results?
Hillary Clinton, Nick. That's who. Yes. And in fact, it's worth also pointing out that there's plenty of people who to this day do not accept the results of the gubernatorial election in Georgia from, was it now 2 years ago? I forget how long ago it is. Stacey Abrams there. But it's also now, just to play the other hand, there's a lot of, like, you know, the people who don't accept that, and Hillary doesn't accept it, what do they do? It's like, I don't personally accept this. Okay. But that doesn't really actually hamper the transference of power or even like the day-to-day. It's as if people are LARPing about their unacceptance or their non-acceptance of things. There is saying, I don't accept this. No matter what happens in the election in November, we can expect Donald Trump to say that there are millions of illegal votes, that there was rampant fraud and abuse. Why do we know? Why can we assume that? Because he said the same thing last time when he won. So for crying out loud, if he loses, he's going to say that's what he does, which is, I think, bad. I think it tarnishes the legitimacy or the perceived legitimacy. But like, what are the impacts of him doing that? I think it degrades political culture. I think it increases the likelihood. And by the way, I think the likelihood is greater if somehow Joe Biden were to lose, that we would see a spike in street violence from the left than we will see if Trump loses from the right, is my prediction here. But like from the actual politicians themselves, I think it's a rhetorical thing, Catherine, that they say more than a thing that they do that we should be worried about. Where am I wrong?
So I completely agree with that. I think it is, as I said at the beginning of my comment, I think it is super, super likely that we are still going to smoothly pull off a peaceful transfer of power. I think a bunch of people are going to complain and be jerk faces, and there's going to be at least one moment when it looks like some goon squad will be somewhere in the near vicinity, and it will turn out that the goon squad was not really called out. But I do think that it is a very, very reasonable position based on the words that the president has said in the last few months and years to say, hey, we should be like a little on alert for this like bad high variance outcome. And that the fact that the president is currently sick and that many of the people around him are currently sick with an illness so serious that the whole world has been upended by it, that like that heightens the risk further. I mean, I don't think that's like a hysterical and catastrophic thing to say. And I think that the handing off from one president to another is the sign of a civilized and peaceful nation. It is a big part of American self-conception. I am very hopeful. I remain very hopeful and confident even that we are going to do that. But I am less hopeful and confident than usual. I do not take it 100% for granted, which I typically have in the past.
Let's put a button on that part of the conversation, please, and go to a less speculative conception here, Peter, which is that last week the House passed a new corona stimulus relief thingy that doesn't necessarily have a huge chance of being taken up in the Senate. However, negotiations are ongoing with Treasury Secretary Mnuchin. And for some reason, the chair of the Federal Reserve,
bless you.
My new policy is if it's close, then mangle it. So that like you can't ever be criticized. Pronunciation. Although you can do that with elections too. But there's also the president in one of his recent tweets, I don't know if it was the all caps flurry of this morning, encouraged people to get together and pass a pre-election thing. So my question to you, Peter, is there anything in there in this gigantic stimia, whatever, that seems responsive to the coronavirus?
There's not a whole lot of direct coronavirus funding included in any of these stimulus packages. Most of them are about propping up people and industries that have been affected by either the lockdowns directly or by the economic changes that have come from social distancing and people being afraid to gather in large groups. And so you have high unemployment in a lot of areas. So there is an extension of the unemployment package that was the unemployment boost that was part of the initial stimulus package, although it is at a lower dollar rate this time. There's money for airlines, although it looks like it's possible that Congress may take that up independently of the stimulus package. This is just about giving people and businesses money to stay afloat and stay alive while the economy has gone to hell. Now it has recovered somewhat versus the sort of peak terrible period in late March and early April, but the recovery is not even close to complete here. And in fact, it looks there are a lot of people who think that we are heading into an even rougher patch over the next 6 months or so, as in that op-ed we discussed at the beginning by Scott Gottlieb and Yuval Levin. They point out that there are worrying signs across the country that there may be a COVID resurgence, that as people move indoors over the winter, that there may be a third wave, they call it, so whatever wave we're on here, and that is going to affect the economy further. And so the whole point of it is to just give people money and hope that that works out. I think there are reasons there are reasons to think those programs aren't going to work nearly as well, nearly as effectively as the boosters think. And, you know, we saw with the unemployment program last time that it was paying people to not work because about 2/3 of the recipients were actually getting more from the boosted unemployment benefit than they would have if they had been working. Now, in many cases, they still would not have been able to work. But you have to imagine that there is some sort of effect there. The PPP, which was the big the Paycheck Protection Program, the big business fund that was built into the last stimulus package, was a disaster in terms of implementation. I mean, it just took forever for some people to get loans. They didn't get the information they needed. The loans were designed in a way that in some cases caused businesses to have to do stuff that just didn't make any sense business-wise and may even have exacerbated their economic problems with regards to COVID and how it's affecting, consumer behavior. And so, as always, Congress is just sort of trying to prop things up without thinking about what comes next. And that's a real problem just in terms of program functionality, but it's also just, it's an issue of finances here at this point. We're going to have a nearly $4 trillion deficit this year. That's so much bigger than even the very large deficits that we have run in previous years. And no one is giving any thought at all to how to pay for this, how to offset this, right? I mean, whether we're going to do spending cuts or tax hikes back end here, whether this makes any kind of sense in the context of the massive debt and deficits that we already have. And you can make the case, I think, if I wanted to make a case for stimulus, the best case would be this is a true crisis. But the reason you don't do deficit spending for years and years, decades and decades, in fact, leading up to this, is because you want to have that fiscal space when you get to the crisis. And it's not clear at all that we have it. And in part, I criticize Republicans a lot on this, but there does seem to be at least some resistance. I won't say it may not be enough in the end, but there does seem to be some resistance at this point to spending trillions and trillions of dollars that we don't have on the part of some Senate Republicans. And so it is... maybe more than two. There are two or three who are speaking out about it. And no, this is the thing. Like, I mean, if you talk to folks in Washington right now, they will say that it's not clear what sort of package could pass because it's not clear that
Trump would say that he supports.
But look, Trump is now stumping for stimulus from the hospital, right? That's what he was tweeting out.
He's a madman. Can't take him seriously.
He's not a details guy. He has had Steve Mnuchin negotiating this. And Mnuchin has been saying, I want to do a $1.6 trillion deal. Pelosi, he's been negotiating it with Nancy Pelosi of the House, who wants to do a $2.2 trillion deal. But there is a fair amount of reporting and saying basically that it's not clear that even if they got the $1.6 trillion deal that Mnuchin wants, that Trump would back, that the Republican votes in the Senate would be there. I am not making a firm prediction on this. I'm just saying there is some reluctance on the part of Senate Republicans
I'm with Peter on this. The Republicans, first off, they're not all of them are up for election, and they are looking forward to a world in which Joe Biden is the president, and they are probably in the minority in the Senate, Matt. I think, you know, the Republicans whose interest in fiscal responsibility has gone missing for at least the past, you know, coming up on 4 years, they're going to find it again as they look forward to a world in which they're in the minority. And they're going to start to say, right, like, oh, my God, all of really, these deficits, we've got to pay for
it's
this.
It's not really about fiscal responsibility about. Or any yep. sort of ideological principle. It is entirely about constraining the Democratic policy agenda.
With which, and getting, to be fair, and getting reelected
to
based
be
on the fiction.
In some ways. In many ways.
With the exception of, I think, Rand Paul and Mike Lee, I would say.
And Susan Collins, of course.
Yes, the great, Susan.
The rock upon which we build our faith.
Nick, I wanted to get a quick little anecdotal from you since you have temporarily decamped to the West Coast. I hope I'm not revealing too
where,
much.
Where over the weekend in Manhattan Beach.
Manhattan Beach.
Yeah. I witnessed a wide number of people being given tickets for failing to wear masks in public, including on the beach. And in one particularly odd instance, myself and my companions, who will not be named because some of them are legal minors, we were eating in a restaurant without a face mask on, and people literally 4 feet away from us on the sidewalk were getting ticketed for not wearing a mask, you know, and getting a $100 ticket for refusing to wear a mask in public. What a wonderful country we live
that
in.
That cough Jesus. In the middle I of mean, that answer really gave it a lot
yeah.
of
oh, it's
yeah.
COVID.
Texture.
Now, I had the COVID. I'm immuno, whatever. I am privileged.
Proficient.
I have the antibodies. I immuno. I try to practice this immuno privileged. Among my many historical crimes is that I have COVID antibodies.
I'm curious as to your sense, because I talked about it last week or the week before. It was pretty rattled, actually, by how kind of freaked out people in California and Southern California are. They just have that kind of thousand-yard stare about a lot of different things, whether you, coming from New York, have a similar thing. As we're, you know, starting to face a possible third wave, and I know you're a third-wave feminist, Nick, but yep. whether you notice any kind of a sense of
I'm a
difference.
Third-wave libertarian.
Yes.
Nick's more of a third-rail feminist, I think.
Yeah, okay, very good. Yeah, I'll take that. I'll run with that.
In addition to the kind of, fascist police state, Brown.
God, it's all coming true. It's just the timing was off of California Uber Alice, man.
The people, the peeps out there, what's your comparative sense of their, because California is much more kind of stringent about, I think they only opened up their playgrounds finally like yesterday after 7 months. So if you have any kind of comparative sense or whether it's,
you know, it's
tentative.
I'll say like Los Angeles is very, it reminds me very much of New York in terms of like, you know, it's kind of open, you know, movie theaters aren't really open and things like that. But, you know, most of the restaurants, they have outdoor seating because of, you know, the weather here is great in Southern California and all that, but similar energy level of. It's open. There's sometimes traffic jams, but nothing is really going on. And there's from the, you know, dozens of people I've talked to. So like, you know, nothing substantial. There's a real sense of dispiritedness. Everybody is kind of, you know, fed up, but they don't quite know what to do.
Yeah,
in Los Angeles,
same, my friend.
Yeah, in Los Angeles, the schools, you know, have been closed. Most of the colleges in California, if not all of them, public and private, are doing all virtual learning. So that is, you know, and when you talk to people with kids of school age, the insanity level gets really jacked up because it's an unsustainable situation of where. Everything is in either a high level of lockdown in terms of economic activity, or it's getting there and people are just starting to chew their own legs off.
Catherine, let's transition a little bit to this week's debate preview. It's the vice presidential debate preview. Those debates always mean so much to the outcome of elections. That was sarcastic. They don't, but they do occasionally provide some interesting fodder for people to chew on. Whether it's, I think today is the anniversary of
You're no Jack Kennedy.
You're no Jack Kennedy, right?
Oh boy, that was so Well, so, that, and you know what? And because of that, Mike Dukakis and Lloyd Bentsen won.
Yeah.
And they ushered in a 1,000-year reign of peace.
I was struck dead almost by watching the cold open to Saturday Night Live this Saturday. It was the season premiere. And I'm not going to be the person who says that Saturday Night Live is no longer funny. I'm just going to say that that was the unfunniest cold open in the history of all television, in which it was a debate thing with Alec Baldwin playing Trump and Jim Carrey trying to play Biden. And then in the middle of it, and this is how it's related to the question, Catherine, you had What's-Her-Face coming out and doing your Kamala Harris impersonation to
Maya
like
Rudolph, Matt.
Thank you. And and her portrayal of them was like she's just Mamala. Like she comes out and she sort of like mothers it and sends the kids to their room. Straying toddler grandparents. And then like tries to discipline Chris Wallace. And it's like, of all of the vibes that Kamala Harris has, being like a mother, just it's as if we have no imagination for who these characters who are running for vice president actually are, what they do, and what their importance is. So I'm asking you to reflect in our weird political and cultural moment. What is the symbolic role of vice president, presidential candidate right now, Catherine?
I do think there's a case to be made that the American people learn one thing about each vice president. Like there's just like one thing you know about each vice, and like, you know, with Dan Quayle, maybe a couple, like there was the potato thing also. You know, like
Darth Cheney.
Pence, I think it's the thing about not having dinner with any ladies besides his wife, which I think we can all agree turned out to be appropriate, both from the Me Too wave and the COVID wave in the end, good behavioral decisions. But I, of course, my formative vice presidential political debate experience was the flawless performance of Admiral Stockdale, which was the moment when he turned off his hearing aid mid-debate. And then didn't know what was going on because he had turned off his hearing aid mid-debate. So I'm just like, I'm looking for that moment from one of these two. Like we have a chance to learn one thing. I think, you know, so far the thing we know about Kamala Harris is that she's a cop, and maybe that's the thing we'll know. But I agree with you, Matt. I don't think the thing that we're gonna learn about her is her like deeply touching maternal elements, because she's a cop instead. But so I guess you know, the vice presidency is not worth a bucket of warm piss, as they have long said, and we will see that on display when these guys talk. On the other hand, they'll probably take turns talking and maybe talk about topics, so like that would be cool.
Peter, what is your sense, if any, of what Mike Pence has done as vice president?
You know, he has taken charge of some White House initiatives that no one has heard of and I have forgotten about, because they don't matter in any way, because they're not even real initiatives, because nothing is real in the world. But in particular, in Trump's White House.
Joe Biden cured cancer, though, while he was vice president. Remember?
He weatherized the economy back into shape, which he brought up. He brought up the debate. He's like, we got to weatherize.
Look, weatherizing houses is no laughing
Biden,
matter.
Biden was Obama's point man for kind of project of the week stuff in the Obama White House. And so a lot of the here's our policy theme for the week stuff that that the Obama administration did, the stimulus, the healthcare bill, a bunch of other things like that, Joe Biden was out front on. And, you know, he just sort of was not even an XO, right? He was just sort of like a figurehead, like a Obama didn't want to do this, so hey, Joe, you take care of this for me. With Pence, it's a little bit different. He just sort of hangs out, and I guess we're waiting for, I mean, you know, he's there in case something happens to Trump, which is a big part of the vice presidential job. But it is interesting, I think, to go back to Pence's record as governor of Indiana. And the thing that stands out to me there is that Pence, after spending a long time criticizing Obamacare, agreed to expand Medicaid under Obamacare. and then pretended that that's not what he had done. He was like, let's, like, I think it's bad to expand Medicaid. I don't want to because I don't want to take all of this federal money to expand the program. I think Obamacare is very bad. And then eventually Indiana under his watch and became the 28th state to do it. And the way he did it was by cutting a deal basically between the state's hospital system and the federal government for the hospital system to get even more money. And so it was this total kind of crony thing for, you know, just to funnel money into the state hospital system, which he then pretended was, oh, this is our free market healthcare plan. No, dude, you're just slightly tweaking the giant federal program that you said you hated and then pretending that you're not going along with it.
Nick, save us from healthcare policy for a second. And I would invite you to imagine this world or sketch out this world, which is that Joe Biden has been around, as we all know, for 47 years. He's got his fingerprints on all kinds of crap in public policy.
Thank you, Matt. Over that an enduring image for early in a week.
Just like your finger. But a vice presidential pick, particularly with someone who is kind of as old and worn out right. as Biden is
and Trump
is by definition an early candidate for the future or the, you know, the trajectory of the political party. So what does Kamala Harris's elevation in this role say about where Democrats are and where they are heading to you, Nick Gillespie?
I don't think it says anything about 2024, to be honest. And if you want to bury somebody, make them vice president for all of the reasons we were talking about, even as Joe Biden eventually became the Democratic nominee 4 years after the fact. But it's, you know, it's like being mayor of New York. It's hard to go from being vice president to president. It really doesn't happen very often. What I think Kamala Harris or Kamala is doing this time around, it's fascinating because she was running as a candidate on a almost complete repudiation of her time as a senator and as an attorney general and as a prosecutor. She's arguably the most pro-pot legalization senator, currently in office, after really dragging her heels on that, you know, when she was able to prosecute people for marijuana problems and things like that. She's no longer a cop. She wants to empty the prisons and be all peace and love. I absolutely think the reason why she got picked is because of her demographics, and she checks a lot of boxes and is not as offensive as some of the other candidates who were out there. So I don't think we can read much into that any more than we could read much into the future of the Republican Party based on Pence being the vice president.
But Catherine, could there not be an argument that the mere fact of checking off boxes says something about where a political party is at?
Sure. I mean, we talked about this when the pick was announced that I was profoundly uneasy with the name the category first and the person second mode in which she was selected. I mean, I think she's highly competent. I think from the question, you know, from the perspective of like, is this a person who is very well qualified to hold the office of vice president? I mean, you know, I suppose arguably literally like a, you know, a turtle would be qualified to hold the
Pence,
office of vice president.
Wait.
We have a turtle
competent.
Running the Senate right now.
Oh, good point. Stop. Waka waka. But at the same time, you know, I think it's fair to say that Nick is right about her current positions, and also that we would be right to doubt them given her long history in office and in power, just as Joe Biden sometimes says the right-ish things nowadays about, for instance, criminal justice reform, while having an incredibly long record of having done huge amounts of harm, and that it remains important to kind of remind people of that and point that out.
And Matt, to actually, you know, maybe to think about things is that appointing Kamala was a repudiation of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. That she ultimately presented as a centrist, in the Democratic presidential nomination process rather than a far left person. Maybe, I mean, this is also, I think, with a Biden presidency, one of the lingering questions, and we'll see how it plays out, is that is Biden actually kind of centrist, even as he's talking about, you know, increasing spending, you know, increasing spending from a baseline projection that is bananas by $11 trillion over the next decade. But he's the moderate. He's the centrist who cut a deal with Bernie Sanders and the Elizabeth Warren wing of the party. Is he actually just going to be overrun by that? But in a way, Kamala was not on the far left of the people who were running for the Democratic nomination this time around.
Her spending plans, we should just note, the Harris spending plans added up to $46 trillion in new spending over a decade or so, something like that. She was much less, let's say, moderate than Joe Biden. And this is, you know,
but not as zany as like Sanders or Warren.
That's, I think, correct. If I want to give the Trump administration a little bit of credit here for an argument they're making about the Biden campaign, it is that Biden has, in fact, moved substantially to the left. He has not gone full Bernie Sanders socialist or anything like that, but he just keeps moving to the left. And it's pretty clearly that he is negotiating not a center of American politics, but a center within the Democratic Party. And that center is moving left, and in particular on spending, on federal spending issues. And so while Biden himself has only $10 or $11 trillion in new proposed spending, this is really an expansion over even just a few years ago with what you saw from Hillary Clinton, with, you know, what we've seen under Obama, which with what we saw from Gore. And, you know, there is real movement there towards the left. And you see it both in Joe Biden himself and in Kamala Harris and how she has campaigned.
I think you see it also in the Republican Party, though. And this is important because Trump, you know, Trump vaguely campaigned as a fiscal conservative at various points.
Which
he was talking
was
about getting
hilarious.
Rid of deficits.
Yes, because he thought he could pay off the national debt with the trade deficit because he did not understand the difference
between the two. From a libertarian point of view, the real issue here, and this is what is, you know, I find deeply disturbing, and I don't know exactly, you know, how do we counteract this, but the entire country has moved to the left, if we're defining the left, you know, moving left as, you know, wanting much more government spending on everything. And, you know, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, and we may be in an era where we're talking about 20 years or 25 years, just an era of massive increases in government, you know, spending and kind of control of various aspects of the economy and of the society and of our culture.
Let us go to our end of podcast cultural recommendations, what you have been consuming and why. Suderman, why don't you go first?
Yeah, I watched the movie Possessor Uncut, which is somehow or another playing in some number of movie theaters and drive-ins across the United States this week, at least for as long as movie theaters continue to stay open. Possessor is a sci-fi horror thriller by Brandon Cronenberg, who is the son of David Cronenberg, and it actually deals with a lot of the same sort of ideas about bodily autonomy and integrity and, you know, psychology. And it's super gory, guys, and it's super disturbing and kind of great. The premise is that there is a corporation of some sort of vague mysteriousness that has a technology that allows someone to take over another person's body via an implant, and then they use that to go do assassinations. You have to get out of that person's body within a certain amount of time. And so our assassin gets stuck in somebody else's body and they kind of go crazy and lose their sense of self and personal identity. Even while, you know, there's a bunch of like stabby murder going on. And it's a great, weird, dark movie for fans of early Cronenberg, you know, the kind of Scanners, Rabid, Brood era. And I think a very promising film by a young filmmaker who has a long time to go.
Nick, what kind of a Dead Ringers-esque culture were you consuming?
Yeah, I'm hoping that David Cronenberg's son came out of his stomach at some point, that he was birthed.
In the bathtub, obviously.
Yeah. But I read, and actually this is a kind of odd thing. I watched a bunch of stuff that was all interesting, but to keep it to just one thing, after interviewing the psychologist Scott Barry Kaufman last week for the Reason Interview podcast that comes out each Wednesday that I do, I reread Transcend, the New Science of Self-Actualization by him, which is, I find an interesting book, which is a kind of refiguring or an extension of Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And Maslow is heavily identified with the concept of self-actualization, of how do you become kind of the best version of yourself or the most aspirational version of yourself. And in post-war America, the human potential movement and a kind of humanistic psychology that Maslow and Viktor Frankl, Rollo May, a number of other people, Carl Rogers, pushed to, you saw it grow up in institutions like Esalen on the West Coast. And the intersection of that with a libertarian sensibility that is shared actually and weirdly in books by people like Ayn Rand, there, you know, there is a weird tension, but also a lot of kind of overlap and synchronicity. And so I found, you know, looking at Abraham Maslow from a vantage point of 2020, particularly in a world where politics is really at a absolute low ebb in terms of providing anything other than anger, frustration, and, you know, death, you know, a death instinct. It's, thinking about self-actualization, Abraham Maslow, is an interesting thing from a particularly libertarian point of view where we want to be beyond politics and get to the real meaning of life. So I recommend Transcend, the New Science of Self-Actualization by Scott Barry Kaufman.
Catherine, what was on your hierarchy of cultural consumption?
I watched the Netflix movie Enola Holmes, which is, it's basically like if Arthur Conan Doyle was Phoebe Waller-Bridge, but G-rated. It's good, is what I'm saying. It's a Sherlock Holmes story about his heretofore undisclosed younger sister, Enola. It has a great Fleabag-esque direct-to-camera skeptical lady eyeballs element, which I tremendously enjoyed. It's based on a popular series of books that are aimed at young adults, thus the G rating, maybe even aimed at kids, to be honest. But it just like a very lovely, nicely put together mystery story with that was very stylish. I think it was meant to be a movie in a movie theater, but we don't have those anymore. So now it's a Netflix thing, and hopefully there will be more. It is the correct movie to watch on your sofa. Probably not the correct movie to go to a movie theater for. But if you, like me and like many nerds, are a fan of all things Sherlock Holmes, I would say go ahead and add Enola to your canon.
Does Sherlock and or Mycroft Holmes show up in this, or?
Both Sherlock and Mycroft are characters. They are, as befits a fairly feminist version of a Sherlock Holmes story, they are sort of stuffed shirts who are, like, frankly, kind of jerks, which I think objectively both of those characters are. Sherlock is played by...
by Henry Cavill. Who has also played Superman.
Is right, he so, shirtless and a buff computer maker videos of note?
He is fully clothed for the entirety of the series, but he is, I think, he becomes yet another
actor.
Does he
have a digital mustache removed from his face? A mustache digitally removed from his face?
Neither of those things.
When they had to do the reshoots for Justice League, he was shooting Mission Impossible Fallout, and he had this ridiculous, just like super thick 70s stash that, like, contractually he was obligated to keep it on his face. So for the reshoots of Justice League, he has a digital upper lip that doesn't have a mustache on it, and
that
it looks.
Like- That sounds like an uncanny valley I do not want to descend into. Thank you very much. No, but he does join the ranks of many Sherlock Holmeses who are also superheroes. If you include both Robert Downey Jr. and Benedict Cumberbatch, you can sort of choose arguably the proto superhero Sherlock Holmes, who has the power of deduction or something.
Although Holmes is not,
or the one in the
he's tights. Not in the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, right? Sherlock Holmes?
A Holmes-like character does right. appear in some of the Alan Moore graphic novels.
Right. But he's like still got a copyright or something, right?
He is not a main part of the cast, certainly not of the cast of the movie or of the original books. Those books developed sort of a cast sprawl later on. My favorite thing about the Enola Holmes press, like it's gotten great reviews, but there was a story that came out at some point, I think last week, where it was like, Netflix is considering a spinoff based on her older brother.
Incredible.
I just want
is
to...
Is there a Chuck Holmes? Matt, you'll understand the reference to Chuck Cunningham. Is there an absolutely older brother who went away to play basketball at college and was never heard from again?
Never came back. Sure me.
You may recall that this is the second hypothetical Holmes brother's younger sister plot since, of course, the BBC Sherlock Holmes was utterly destroyed in its final season by a surprise younger sister as well. So if we have to choose one surprise younger sister of the Holmes brothers, I'm Team Enola for sure.
Also on Team Enola are my tween daughter and her friend who watched that in a sleepover and gave it 4 thumbs up between them. I watched last week the South Park Pandemic special, the highest rated episode in 7 years, according to Variety. Mm. Trade publication, and it was very therapeutic. It's as silly as it sounds, like seeing Cartman drop F-bombs to his mom just made me feel a little bit better about my life choices.
it's nice. Also, Cartman was objectively pro lockdown.
Again, it was very much like my tween, who's is resentful that she has to go to school even once a week because she was kind of like leaning into the whole not interact with other human beings thing. So I now am using Cartman as a parenting tool against my 12-year-old, which is all well and good. And the only note that I would somewhat sour note that I would add to this otherwise very recommendable thing by these guys who are just unbelievably creative, even in their like third decade of the show, is like as soon as Donald Trump shows up, like it gets bad, real bad in a hurry. It's really strange. There's a Trump blind spot, it seems to me, although maybe I've just been overly influenced by Nick Gillespie on this point. But anyways, that's all the Nick Gillespie influence we have time for on this program. Please look at all of our podcasts over at reason.com/podcasts, including the Soho Forum. Do not forget, there's recently a Cracker Jack episode involving whether pods are a good idea. And I don't mean podcasts, but parents know what I'm talking about. But anyways, go check all that out. And my God, we can only imagine how much crap's going to happen between now and next Monday. It should be all fun. I note, looking at Reason Slack channel, that Kayleigh McEnany, the press secretary of the White House, is now saying that she's tested positive. So add that to the list of positive coronavirus cases emanating from the White House. And let's just see what happens in this crazy world of ours. Thank you for listening and goodbye.